This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
What seems like long, long ago, there was Liberation Day when the President of America announced all the trade tariffs he was going to impose on goods from other countries. Then, when the markets tanked, he unannounced most of them, saying there would be a 90-day pause for negotiation. In those 90 days, there would be 90 deals. That 90 days ended with two deals, almost, including ours. So the deadline was promptly extended to next month. And in the past few days, the White House has been sending out a flurry of letters, once again threatening higher tariffs for those without a deal, which is almost everyone. On Wednesday night, Trump's Brazilian letter threatened a 50% tariff on that country's goods, in part because he doesn't like the fact that its former Trump-friendly president is on trial. And so, the great Trump trade hokey-cokey, in, out, shake it all about, carries on. But what has been the effect on world trade so far? How have other countries responded? Have there been any winners from all this, or just losers? And what next? Step into the briefing room, and if you don't immediately step out again, together we'll find out. First, let's recap and remind ourselves how this started earlier this year. The Briefing Room's Caroline Bailey spoke to Soumaya Keynes, economics columnist at the Financial Times.
Soumaya Keynes, remind us how Trump's tariff hokey-cokey, as we've been calling it, started. Does this go back to his first term?
In his first term, he certainly showed a fondness for tariffs. But actually, if you look at what happened, it was fairly narrow in its kind of application. So in his first term, you had tariffs on steel, aluminium, and then you obviously had massive tariff increases on China. What we've seen in his second term, though, is that things have escalated. So we've got a much broader application of these tariffs. So we had Liberation Day on April the 2nd, when he stood up and announced much, much broader tariffs on essentially all of America's trading partners. Mexico and Canada got dealt with slightly separately, but they were affected by tariffs too. And then you also have specific sectoral tariffs. So tariffs on cars, there are tariff investigations ongoing. So we could end up getting tariffs on pharmaceutical products, chips, all sorts of things. So it's gone from quite a narrow application in his first term to something just much, much broader in his second term.
How did he determine the level of tariffs? There was a strange mathematical formula, I seem to remember.
Yes. So each country had its own specific number, and that number depended on the American trade deficit in goods with that country. So if America imported lots more goods from a country than it exported the other way, then that country would face a higher tariff. It wasn't the most economically watertight exercise, but what they were trying to do was set the number so that with various very strong assumptions, if you apply that tariff, the trade deficit might fall to zero. That was the sort of underlying logic for those numbers. Lots of economists came out and said, that's not going to work. This is a strange exercise. But what it did do is it gave the Trump administration some big numbers to whack its trading partners with.
And which countries were hit the hardest initially?
Surprisingly, it was lots of countries in kind of Southeast Asia that were hit relatively hard. So Cambodia, Vietnam got a tariff of 46%. China got a tariff of 34%. That's pretty hefty. The EU got a tariff of 20%. Obviously, these are really big trading players, right? And so they were hit hard also because they send a lot of exports to the US. But what you also see with lots of smaller countries, maybe a country so small that it can't actually afford to import very much from America. And so actually it does have a pretty big trade imbalance in goods. They got hit by really, really large tariffs. So some of the highest rates went to places like Lesotho, not exactly a kind of major trading adversary of the US, but that's just how the formula worked out.
So what was the reaction and what happened next?
The reaction wasn't great. Other countries did not enjoy being hit with these tariffs, but it was actually in lots of cases relatively muted. I think politicians were making the calculation that they were going to try to negotiate some kind of carve out. And if they were going to do that, it didn't actually make sense to be too hot-headed and to rail too strongly against the US administration. I think in some parts of Asia, there was also a concern that if you are too angry about this in public, maybe the US could escalate, maybe the US could remove security guarantees, right? That was an area where they feel very, very nervous about. And actually, where the reaction was kind of most scary was in the bond market. It was in the market for US government debt. And that was the thing that I think really tipped things and got people feeling very, very nervous. And so what happened essentially is on April 9th, the president said, oh, actually, we've changed our mind. We're going to pause these things for 90 days, and we're going to use that time to negotiate deals for countries to get out of those higher tariffs later.
And how did that go? Did the negotiations happen?
The negotiations did happen, but not quite at the pace that the president was hoping for. I think at first there was talk of 90 deals in 90 days. That estimate has been pared back considerably. We saw some kind of agreement with the UK. There was something with Vietnam published more recently. But really what's been happening is they've been trying to negotiate agreements, and lots of countries haven't caved as quickly as the Trump administration thought they would. But also they've just discovered that the details of these things really, really matter. And you need time to work them out. And they just haven't given themselves enough time.
How did the UK manage to strike a deal with the US when others haven't?
So I think at a basic level, the UK probably got lucky. President Trump decided he wanted to announce something and the UK was kind of closest. I think at another level, the UK is smaller than some of the other negotiating partners. The EU, China, in those negotiations, they have more leverage, right? And so they're going to push back harder against some of the US demands. I think the UK was probably being a bit more pragmatic about what it could try to get out of this negotiation. The real issue, the real way that the UK managed this is that if you look at the text of the deal, it doesn't achieve a huge amount. I'm actually just going to quote from the text of the deal, right? Both the United States and the United Kingdom recognize that this document does not constitute a legally binding agreement. That's a weird thing to have at the top of a deal, like shaking someone's hand and saying, oh, but FYI, this handshake doesn't mean anything. And actually, what has happened since they negotiated that deal is the fact that it was pretty light on lots of the details has really become clear. So for example, in steel, the agreement was to try to negotiate an agreement in future. And that left uncertainty about whether UK steel exports were really exempt from kind of higher tariffs. And as of July 9th, we still don't actually know what tariff rate UK steel is going to be hit by.
Sumaya Keynes. Before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about the row over disability benefits, who gets them and how much it's costing, and the one which asks what happens next in Iran. Back now to tariffs. We've heard about how we got to this point, but I want to find out how other countries have responded and what it all means for world trade, and then what comes next. I'm joined by Meredith Crowley, who's Professor of Economics at the University of Cambridge, Justin Wolfers, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of Michigan, and journalist Philip Coggan. He's just written a book on all this, The Economic Consequences of Mr. Trump, What the Trade War Means for the World. Meredith Crowley, before we go any further, what is the legal status of a Trump trade deal? If you sign one, what's to stop him or his successor just changing it when they feel like it?
There's really nothing to stop a successor from changing whatever deal a country signs and agrees to with President Trump, because at the moment, he's not planning to implement this into a new U.S. law. So it's really just an agreement between the president and what he would do as executive for the rest of his term.
Right. So does that mean if it went through, had gone through Congress, it would be a law and it wouldn't be changeable like that? But if he just does it off his own bat, then he can change it whenever he wants.
Yeah. So if he wants to introduce a new bill in Congress to change the U.S. tariff schedule, he could certainly do that. And if Congress supports it, that could be implemented in U.S. law. If he does something where he sets, for example, one tariff under the general U.S. code on, say, the UK and a different one on the European Union, because those are both members of the WTO, he would be violating WTO law.
The World Trade Organization.
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, the World Trade Organization. So the U.S. is committed under the World Trade Organization to treat World Trade Organization members such as the UK, Japan, the European Union equally. And so what that means is the U.S. is obliged by its own domestic law to follow the principles of the World Trade Organization. There is a law that says the U.S. will do that in U.S. law. So when he changes and sets different tariffs on different countries, that will be a violation of the World Trade Organization agreement and what's known as the Uruguay Round Agreement Act in the United States.
But it looks like he's going to carry on with that anyway. Justin, how have other countries responded to the Trump tariffs announced so far, both back on Liberation Day and as they have then subsequently mutated?
So the first thing to understand is in just about every country around the world, this has been front page news and one of the most important telenovelas that people have been following from day to day. In terms of the policy responses, there's basically two and a half categories. If you're a very small country, even just take my home country of Australia, the idea of putting retaliatory tariffs just doesn't make a lot of sense. You're not punching with enough weight that the Americans are going to listen, and it might even make you a bit more of a target for the schoolyard bully. And so small countries have basically copped it on the chin so far and not come up with any real policy response. If you're a large country, you could think about retaliating. Now, the thing about retaliating is if you raise your own tariffs, yes, that's going to hurt American exporters, but will also hurt consumers in your own country. And so that would be the argument for not retaliating. But by the same token, if you're hoping for better treatment in the future, that might help. And so that's what we've seen most notably from China. And the European Union has definitely talked about retaliating. And I said it's two and a half responses. And the half is you could try and negotiate a deal. What exactly that means, what the US wants, and how you get into the White House to see the trade negotiators all remains incredibly unclear, which is why essentially no one, and I realize I'm talking to a British audience, but essentially no one has followed that track.
Justin, have people actually been able to get to the White House to negotiate these trade deals?
80 days ago, 90 days ago, the White House was boasting that every country in the world was calling, saying, could we strike a deal? Now, that's also the case that when we have a big storm, everyone calls their plumber. When things go wrong, you try and call and figure out what to do. And then last week, we had Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent say, well, the problem is that many of these countries never even called. The reality is that those who did call were saying, something's gone wrong, how can we fix it? They weren't necessarily saying, what can I give you in order for you to restore reasonable and fair trade between the two nations? And the real problem has been one of capacity. Normally a trade deal takes 1 or 2 years to negotiate with a dedicated trade team. This White House was talking about doing 90 deals in 90 days. Normally you can put a lot of the responsibility for negotiating down to your bureaucrats, But this White House has insisted that the only person who can sign off on a deal is the president. And the president seems to change his mind and what he wants, and also the baseline for negotiation every couple of days or so. There's a story that didn't get reported a lot, that the chief Japanese trade negotiator was in Washington, D.C. to meet with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. He couldn't get a meeting. He got two 15-minute phone calls with a different cabinet secretary, extended his stay 24 hours, more or less hanging out on the periphery of the White House, and couldn't get in. And that's one of our most important trading partners.
Philip Coggan, can we move to the question of what impact the Trump tariffs have had on the world economy in the last 3 months? What was the initial reaction and how's it bedded down?
Well, there was a big rush to import stuff to the US in the first quarter of the year because people knew the tariffs were coming. So it's a bit like hoarding before, you know, the pandemic. Suddenly people got in. So that has muted the effects. But then the announcement of the tariffs caused a hit to both consumer confidence and business confidence. Retail sales in the States have been pretty flat. And the forecasts for what will happen in the rest of the year have gone down. So the World Trade Organization is forecasting a slight fall in trade this year. The World Bank about a halving in the global rate. And the real problem is the confusion that Justin has talked about. There's a lot of talk about Donald Trump's kind of incredible strategy that he's playing four-dimensional chess, but he's really playing darts with a javelin. All he's achieving is smashing the board and causing damage to everybody around him.
Right. So it was fair to say that world trade's not drastically declined. But of course, quite a lot of the original tariffs that were threatened have not actually gone into effect. So how are people trading in the context of not knowing what might happen in the immediate future?
The logical thing for people to do is to wait and see what the final tariffs might be. Though, of course, he could change his mind again even when he does a deal. So there has been assumption in the financial markets particularly that Trump will not push through these tariffs. The financial markets recovered substantially. And businesses, those which got imports in the first 3 months of the year, have not yet passed on higher prices to American consumers. But if it happens that the tariffs that have been announced in the last few days that might come into effect after August the 1st do go through, then you'll see much more adverse effects on the economy and on business in the rest of the year.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Meredith Crowley, a kind of two-part question to you, but the first part of the question is, we did have tariffs in Trump's first term. How was world trade affected back then? What was the consequence?
So the main consequence was U.S. imports from China declined quite substantially by about 30%. But we had a compensating increase in U.S. imports from Mexico and also quite a significant increase in imports from Southeast Asia, especially Vietnam. So one of the things that's going on here is that, for example, some product that used to be manufactured in China could change its manufacturing process to take place in Mexico. It could still import parts from China, put them into the final product being made in Mexico, and then ship it onto the US. Similar things with Vietnam. So basically, once people understood that the tariff increase against China was going to be in place for a substantial period of time, investors very sensibly moved their operations out of China and into other locations that had lower tariff rates.
Right. And I think I'm right in saying some of the tariffs that Trump imposed back in his first term were actually maintained by the Biden administration.
All of them were, substantially. So there was no change when President Biden came into office. I think basically he agreed with many of the objectives of what President Trump had done. He was very concerned about the well-being of lower skilled workers. And I think politically, it was seen as it would be a very negative thing for his party if he removed the tariffs. He didn't necessarily think they were effective in creating jobs. So he followed up with something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which was really focused on increasing jobs in the green energy sector.
So I imagine that one of the objectives that Trump has had this time, you were talking earlier about how imports shifted effectively from China to places like Vietnam, was to try and get rid of that that effect.
Yeah, I think it in some sense, it makes a lot of sense that once you realize, oh, putting a tariff on China is just going to shift imports to other countries, it logically would lead one, if you want to restrict imports overall, to raise the tariff on other parties like Mexico or Vietnam.
Justin, we've just talked there about Vietnam, and Vietnam seems to be quite an interesting case in point about how to react to the Trump tariffs. Can you take us through what Vietnam has done and what lessons we can derive from it?
Yes. So under the April 2 set of tariffs, Vietnam was going to face something very, very high. I think it was a 40% tariff that would have been immensely destructive. It actually is the one country that sat down and did a deal. Now, I want to put an asterisk next to what I'm about to say, which is no one has released text of the deal that was made. But what the president has posted on social media is that Vietnam has agreed to put no tariffs on any goods from the United States. And the United States is going to continue to put a 20% tariff on Vietnam. An important thing for Vietnam is that puts their tariff rate below the Chinese tariff rate. And so for a lot of their industries, China is a very direct competitor. And as long as they can sneak below, their industries are going to be okay. You might be a little confused about the asymmetry there. Why is Vietnam willing to impose no tariffs, zero tariffs in exchange for this? And one answer is that that's the best decision for Vietnam, actually, irrespective of whether the US gave it anything. There's an old saying from Joan Robinson, who used to teach at Meredith's College, that just because someone else puts rocks in their harbour doesn't mean you should put rocks in yours. What she meant by that is tariffs are essentially a friction. They make it difficult for ships to come in and to leave. And just because someone else makes it difficult for ships to come in and to leave doesn't mean that you should. In fact, it's probably almost always going to be better to have an efficient port in your country. So at a deep level, maybe this was a Vietnam first decision for Vietnam, and along the way, they got something from the United States.
But Justin, the logic of that is that all the damage, therefore, is going to be inflicted, self-inflicted, by the United States on itself.
Not all the damage, but a large amount of the damage. So American tariffs hurt Americans and foreigners. Vietnam's tariffs hurt Vietnam and foreigners. So when Vietnam gets rid of Vietnam's tariffs, what it's doing is getting rid of the pain on the Vietnamese people. And it also, just as a side effect, is getting rid of pain on others. Now, unless you're a sociopath, eliminating pain on others is rarely a reason to not do something. But your point is absolutely correct. If you look at the extent to which organizations like the IMF or the World Bank have marked down their forecasts for the performance of economies around the world, the United States is one of the biggest victims of Trump's policies. It's going to hurt the American people tremendously.
Phil, we've heard just in the last week of, in fact, just in the last day or so, about a letter to Brazil, which says we're going to impose a 50% tariff for various reasons, but one of which is we don't like the way you're treating your former president. I'm just wondering how this affects America as the central economy to which other countries look, if something like this can happen so whimsically.
Yes, if you think back to after the Second World War, the US set up a global system under the wise leadership of Harry Truman and George Marshall of gradually freeing trade, gradually reducing barriers, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades that led into the World Trade Organization, and bringing the European and other democratic nations into its net. So the US was kind of the global leader to which other people looked as an example. And now we find that the US is seen as the kind of troublemaker in the room. You have the G7 has become the G6 plus one, with other leaders just having to deal with President Trump as a troublemaker, as a disruptor. And we've seen statements from the likes of Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, or Friedrich Merz of Germany, to say, you know, we can no longer rely on the US anymore, not just in trade, but in defence, in standing up for democracy. And that is a loss to the US as well in terms of its soft power. You can see it in the sales of Tesla. You know, Tesla was a global symbol of American technology. Its sales have plummeted by half in Europe over the last year, but because people no longer want to be associated with that brand.
Meredith Crowley, just to look very briefly at the effect in the United States itself, do we think that the electorate in the United States has fully comprehended what the tariff effects would be, or do you think that comprehension is yet to come?
I think they have not fully understood the consequences of the tariff impact. I think one of the things that's very difficult for ordinary people to see is it's hard to relate a change in one tax policy to the price you pay for things you buy, whether it's a car or whether it's, you know, food or some kind of consumer good like a new television. We know from the first round of Trump tariffs in 2018 that in the first 18 months, which have been very well studied, there was basically every tariff imposed on a good from China was fully passed through into the price paid by the first purchaser in the United States. This is unusual because sometimes exporters will actually lower their price when they know their customer has to pay a higher tax. The thing is, most of those first purchasers were distributors, wholesalers, firms that were putting parts into their final consumption good. So the price that consumers paid didn't really rise in these first 18 months. And so for them, they saw tariffs go on, but they didn't necessarily feel the impact in their pocketbook. That increase in the level of US prices unrolled much, much more gradually. I suspect this time, if President Trump does go ahead with, you know, broad 30% tariffs and he doesn't succeed in getting deals, the impact will be more sudden.
Philip Coggan, one of the things, the offsetting features of this policy, and one of the reasons why it was supposed to be popular, was the idea you'd bring back manufacturing industry into the United States as a consequence. So you might lose a bit at the beginning. In fact, I think President Trump said so. You lose a bit at the beginning. But the big prize is the repatriation of manufacturing industry. Is expert opinion of the opinion that that will happen?
No. Because manufacturing employment has been declining as a proportion of the total for decades. It has across the Western world in countries like Germany, which has a big trade surplus. Because it's not about trade. It's about technology. Technology has been reducing the number of workers needed to make a given good.
Justin, let's wrap up by asking what you think happens now. I mean, all these letters are going out. Even if people can't get meetings in the White House, they're going to get the letters anyway. What do you anticipate going down in the next few months?
Wall Street thinks that what happened this week with the letters going out, the most important part was the July 9th deadline got extended out to August 1st. And in the first Trump administration, there was an ongoing joke that next week would always be infrastructure week and they never got around to it. And Wall Street feels very calm because they've convinced themselves that tariffs are the new infrastructure week and nothing's going to happen. There's a different view, which I subscribe to, which is the president's utterly sincere in his love of and belief in tariffs. He campaigned on them. He implemented them to a small degree in the first term and really allowed himself to get talked out of them both in the first term and with the recent pause. But he's pretty determined to push on. And if this were your view, then we're basically right now hearing the early days of Liberation Day Part 2, the sequel. This is the summer rerun in which we move back to these very high tariffs. But perhaps this time, and I want you to cue the Jaws music as you listen to this, perhaps this time the tariffs actually stick, which means we get these punitively and prohibitively high tariffs. We then spend the next couple of months saying, yes, but I don't see big effects in the data. But then so slowly we understand that macroeconomies move slowly. And so through late 2025 through to 2026, we start to see price rises and public opinion harden against this. And that might be the next opportunity for the president to revisit.
So that's all we have time for. My thanks to Justin Wolfers, Meredith Crowley, Philip Coggan and Soumaya Keynes. And my conclusion? What else could it be but knees bend, arms stretch? Rah, rah, rah. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirstine Knight and Sally Abrahams. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundele. The sound engineers were Neil Churchill and David Crackles. The editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
I'm David Runciman, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Post-War.
From the cradle to the grave, they said.
80 years on, we're telling the story of the 1945 election and the creation of post-war Britain.
There must be a revolution in our way of living.
This is the Britain that many of us grew up in, and which still shapes an idea of who we think we are.
Even Winston Churchill thrown out. All right, you may have won the war, but are you going to win the peace?
Post-war with me, David Runciman. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Can we have the Britain we desire?
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.